Now let's read number 10 and 12. Weath, Resen, Bain, Nineveh, Uvain, Kalah, Heve, Heder, Hagedolah. Now let's go back up. Weath is we and the sign of direct optics. Risen. And that's a city. And risen. What does risen mean? Does any one of you remember what that meant? It means fortress. Risen means fortress. Between, Bayin. Bayin here means a breathing space. There was a space between. Bayin. Originally, the earth, the ground, or the land of the earth, and the waters below. You know, the earth was... I do this because some people watching this on the internet don't know what I'm saying at all. Period. They don't know this. The earth one time was earth and Maim waters, like that. But around the earth was an ocean in the sky. And right here is called a bayan. This is a breathing space. It's an interval between here and here. And between cities, we use the same word, bayin, which means an interval or a breathing space between the two cities. Now, what's wrong with all this right now? What's going on here? What is wrong? Were they supposed to build cities? No, they're supposed to spread out and live a nomadic life. You have cities, you have what? Problems, conjunction, disease, all of this. Why did the American Indian, why did God bless them so greatly here in North America? Because they didn't live in big cities. They spread out. They lived. They had farms. They had all of this stuff. But they lived. They moved. Sometimes they'd have winter homes and summer homes, kind of like that snowbirds do now. You know, they did that. Even up there in Fish Lake Valley where I lived, they would stay in Fish Lake Valley in the summer, and they'd migrate down to Death Valley in the wintertime. Those Shoshone Indians will do that. Risen between breathing space, Nineveh. Now look at this word, Nineveh. What does Nineveh mean? Brother Roger, you remember looking that word up before?
No.
Nope. That means handsome. Handsome and agreeable. Handsome and agreeable. It's on the southeast bank of the Tigris River. Nineveh. And Nineveh in Greek is N-I-V-E-U-E-A. It's like nun, iota, nun, echo, or epsilon, that is, ypsilon, and eta. I get my Greek and Hebrew so mixed up I can't tell which one's what when I'm trying to spell. Nineveh. The handsome place, the agreeable place. And Uvain, and Uvain here means we start off with a conjunction, page 253, if you want to write that down, that U on the front of it. That's a wow, and that's a conjunction on the front of a word. Uvain, which means what? A breathing space or an interval between, and between these cities, and Kalah. Kalah became the capital of the Assyrian Empire later on. And that means strong, stern, rugged, firm. Kalah. And then we have that. We have a third person pronoun here, masculine and feminine, either one, and also a demonstrative pronoun, and that word hue. And then Ha'eder. Ha'eder. What does Ha'eder mean, Brother Roger?
Fortress city.
Ha is a definite article on the front of it. Eder means a place that has watchtowers, a place that's watched or cared for, you know, protected. The word is Gregorio, polis in the Septuagint. Gregorio means to watch. And then Greg, Hagedolah. And in the Greek there, it's Megale, megale, megale. What English word do we use? What English words do we use for megale? When you go to McDonald's, you say mega size it. Mega bunch. Make it bunch. Make it big. Okay. Now, let's go on to 13, verse number 13. Yumitzraim. Yalad. Et. Ludim. We et. Anamim. We et. Lu. Luha Baim. And then we et. Naftu Chim. And you Mitzrayim. You on the front of that is a conjunction, page 253 again, Brown, Driver, and Briggs. And then it says here, Mitzrayim. What in the world's Mitzrayim? What is Mitzrayim?
Egypt.
What does Mitzrayim mean?
Red
mud and canal banks. In other words, it's an irrigated place, a place that irrigates their farms. And then the word in Greek is Egyptos, which we get our word Egyptos from it. Here in the Septuagint, it's called Mitzrayim. It transliterates it right into the Septuagint. But later on, we hear of Egypt called Egyptos, and that's where we get our English word Egypt from. And Mitzrayim, he had begotten. He had begotten. Third person masculine singular, cal perfect. What does this word begotten mean, Brother Roger?
To create.
That means to create. It means to bear. And it's a live birth. It's like technos in Greek. Here, it uses in the Greek Septuagint, is agenese. Agenese. And he begat et, the sign of the direct object, and then we ludim, or lud. And this word, it's the African nations. This is the African nations. This is North Africa and through that area. The name means generation or nativity. It also can mean firebrands or travailings or strife, warring. And then African nations, have there been a lot of warring over there for a few years? Constant warring, isn't it? Wiet. That's a conjunction and then the sign of the direct object. And anamim, the anamina. The Latin here from this word is amur, which means what? Amur. Amare. Amareto.
Love.
Huh? Love. Thank you very much. You got an A+ for that. Here, this is northern Egypt, and it means people that migrate. Are rock men, people that live in the rocks, in the mountains. And the Libyans, these Libyans here, the Libyans, of course, that's in where. And Libyan means red-colored, flame-colored. These are the Libyans. It's Labiim in Greek. Labiim. And the Naphtuhim. The Naphtalim is what it says. Naphtalim, it means openings. Openings.
Okay, hold on.
Yes.
I'm missing something. We went from Ladim to Anamim to. I'm missing one of them.
Neph. Anamim, the Libyans.
What's Anamim? Libyan?
Anamim, that's the Latin for amare, you know. That's the Latin for love. They might trace it back to here. It meant the people that migrate. It also means faith. In African, it means faith. It means to believe.
So the anamim. Latin is the
yeah,
word.
It's this word. I told you the Latin root of it. The African root of it is to have faith. And we go back to the Hebrew, and it may mean rockmen, and it's the northern Egypt. All right, northern Egypt. I have down here the Megarites. Then we have the Libyans. We know where Libya is. We had trouble with the Libyans in the last few decades. And it means flame-colored red. These are Egyptians. These are Libyans. Labaim. And the Naphtalim. Naphtalim. And this is central Egypt. And that means openings. Opening. Now let's go to 10 and verse 14. And then we'll go, when we get some of these verses down, we're going to go back and we're going to read about the accomplishments of these people that we're talking about right here. We have, that's the conjunction, and the sign of the direct object, and we have, and the, we have, pathrusim, pathrusim, we have, kasluchim, asher, yatsiyu, misham, pi, lishtim, Weet Kaftorim. And the sign of the jet objects and the Parthrusians. The Parthrusians. This is the fifth son of Mitzrayim. On page 837 it tells you about this. This is Upper Egypt. And the Kasluchim. This may be one of the roots of the word Philistine, by the way. This is Upper Egypt. The Hashemites, and according to the Septuagint, these are the Hashemites, the Hashemim. Psalm 68 and verse 31, and 1 Chronicles 1 and 12. And then it says from where they went out, they had gone out, actually they had gone out, from there, Misham, me is a preposition, Sham is from there, name, place, monument, whatever. From there, the Philistines. These are the Philistines. These are, this is the land of wanderers, the Philistines. And these Philistines, it means the migrators. Philistia, migration, wanderer, nomadic. The Philistines are... super capitalist, super materialist is what they were. They wanted, they were materialists. These were they were intolerant. They, this area where the Philistines were was about 40 by 10 miles. Ekron, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gaza, Gath, Gerar. And there's many references to them from Genesis 21:32 onward. And then the Kaftorim, Kaftorim. This word Coptus or Coptic comes from that. That's Latin, of course. And it means servant. Servant. Then 10 verse 15, Yuchenaim. Yalad. Et Sadan, Bicharo, Weet Chet, and Canaan. And Canaan means what? Possession. Canaan means possession. It also means low and flat land, Canaan. And he had begotten, Sidon. All right, Sidon means what? Sidona is in the Greek word for Sidona. And that means fortress. The Judges 10 and verse 12, 1 Kings 16, 31. We talk about Jezebel there. 2 Kings 23, 13. Ezekiel 32 and verse 30. These are all going talking about Sidon. Tyre and Sidon. And his firstborn, Bicharo, we at Heth. Heth, what does Heth mean? It, in the Greek, it's it is ketaion, ketaion, ketaion. It means terrible. These were terrible people. These were vicious, These were terrible people. These people, these Hethites, were mean people. Terrible. Now let's go a little bit further. 10 and verse 16. Weeth. Ha visi. Weeth. Ha imori. Weeth. He ger gashi. And the Jebusites. These are the people that were in Jebus. Where was Jebus? You remember? Look up here on that picture of Jerusalem over there. I wish I had somebody to move the camera. Jebus is right over here in that lower part right there. That's Jebus, the old city of Jebus. Have you been there, Sharon? You've been to Jebus where they told you where the Jebusites and everything. The word Jebus means what? Jebus. It means trodden down, to tread down. Trodden down or to tread down. This is the old word for Jerusalem, the Jebusites. This is where Melchizedek was. This is where David went in there. Jebus, the old city of David, was right there where Jebus was. And then we have, and we eth Amorite. Amorites, the Amorite. Amorion, Amorion. That's what the Greek word is. And these were mountain dwellers. They had a variety of gods. They were mountaineers. These people dwelled in the mountains, these Amorites. And Ha-Girgashi. This is the Girgashites, the Girgashites. These people dwelled around the Sea of Galilee. The Galilee means what?
Circle.
Genesis 15:21, Deuteronomy 7:1, Joshua 3:10, 1 Corinthians. Chronicles 1:14, Nehemiah 9:8. And this name usually is in plural. In the plural. Not singular. Gergesite is singular, but it's usually used in the plural. 10:17. Weeth. Ha Chavi. Weeth. Ha Arki. Weeth. Hasani. And then it says, and it says, we, eth, and the sign of the direct objects, the ha-chewi, the Hivite. Uaon is the Greek word for this in the Septuagint. And this is a villager. The Middlelanders, a Shechem. All right, a place full of people. It means commercially, a commercial place, a place of commerce, commerce-oriented place, the Hivites. And the Arkites. This is between the Dead Sea and Mount Sinai, 12 miles north of Tripoli. And this word Arkite means fugitive or... It comes from, in Greek, it's arukaion, or arka, belonging to arka. And then the Sinite. What does Sinite mean? What, you remember what that Sinite means, Sinai? What does Sinai mean? Moses went on Mount Sinai, and what did he mean? What did he see up there? What did he see, brother?
He saw God.
He saw God, but what did he see before he saw God?
The Shekinah glory.
Yeah. But what was on fire up there? What was on fire, Sharon? A blackberry bush was on fire and it wouldn't quit burning, would it? So this is a place of brambles and thorns. Sinai means a place of brambles and thorns. Brambles and thorns, the thorn bushes, the place of the thorn bushes, which is the blackberry bush. That's what Moses saw on fire, was a blackberry bush. And these Sinites that inhabited the area were a tribe of Canaanites. 10 and 18. Weeth, Har Awadi, Weeth, Hatsimari, Weeth, Hachamati, We akar. Nafotsu. Mishpi chof. Hakaani. And the Arvadite. Arvod means refuge. Near Shechem, Ramah. These Arvadites and the Samarites. The Samarites. This is the foot of Lebanon where this is. The Samarites. And the Hamathite. Amarthi is the word. Amarthi. This means a defense or walled in the extreme northern Palestine. And then it says we achar, that means afterward, and afterward, became, and they became, they had become literally, they had become abroad, the Mishpatha means paterfamilia. In Latin, paterfamilia. What's paterfamilia? The father of the family. Hapatria in Greek. The oikos, the house of the father. Mishpatha literally means from one semen, from one sperm, from one semen, all these people spread from one semen. That's what it literally means. The Canaanite, Canaan, it's Cananion in the Greek, Septuagint, the Canaanites. And who are the Canaanites? These are the ones that were cursed by God because Ham possibly had relationships with his own mother. She brought forth this child, which was Canaan, which was a cursed child because of that behavior. And this is the father of these people right here. This is the father, the Canaanites. 10 and verse 19. Javul, Hakinani, Mitzidon, Bakar, Gorara, Ad, Aza, Bu, Cha. Got so much writing here, I can't hardly read my own writing. Sidoma. We Amara. We Ad. Adama. Yutzi. Voyim. Ad. Lasha. And became, literally, Gavul became border. It's Gabol. Came border. The Canaanites, these are the ones from the low of the flat land, possession from Sidon. Sidon means fortress. And you are going, it says here, second person masculine scene or cal infinity construct. You are to be going toward Gerar. Gerar means circle. That's a very ancient city south of Gaza. A very ancient city. This is the birthplace of Isaac, by the way. The wells were in this area in Gerar were dug by Abraham and then reopened by Isaac. They had gone back in there and filled these wells in so Abraham's family could not water their flocks there. They were fighting, you know, they're trying to keep them from being in this land. And then Ad means as far as Azah, which is Gaza. This is the strong place, one of the five cities of the Philistines, Gaza. And Bo'aka. And you are to go, or be going, Sodom. Sodoma, the place of sulfur and lime. That's what Sodom means. And Gomorrah. Gomorrah means submission, fissure, and these are two of the cities that were in the plain that were destroyed. These cities are not very far from Jericho, and Jericho was a very ancient city. Gomorrah. And Admah, and Zeborim, in the valley of Sidon. These are the five cities. Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboim, and Lasha, as far as Lasha. Lasha means bursting forth, also called Kolin Ho. 10 and verse 20. I'm just reading through this thing so you can get this down. It may be a little bit boring doing this because we're not saying too many exciting things, but let's get to here and then we're going to go find out about these people. Eleh, Vene, Kam, Lishma Pita, Lilshonatham, Beart Sotam, Bego Yeham. These, Ele, these sons of Ham. Ham means what? Dark, swarthy, hot, violent, dark, swarthy. And then we have Le Mishpashatham. And this after the semen are the fathers of the families, is what it's talking about, the pater familia, the pater oikos pater. It is families or tribes, phulos in Greek, phulos, tribes. And then it says here, in their nations. And it's plural and ending here, in their nations. And this word in Greek is ethnesin, which we got the word ethnic from, ethnesin. Ethnesin auton, the ethnic background of them is what it says in the Septuagint. Do you like knowing what it means in these different languages? My great-great-grandfather spoke 17 languages fluently. I don't speak that many, but I'm trying to catch up a little bit. It's a little bit late in life, but I'm trying to. 10:21, Yulishem, Yelad, Gam, Hu, Avi, Akal, Benay, Ever, Achi, Yefeth, Hagadol, that is. Now let's go and read some of this. Yulishem. Let's look at that word here just a little. Yulishem. This is a compound word, isn't it, Sharon? Tell me a little bit about that. What's on the front of it? That
you. The U would be an and.
And or a conjunction. And then how about the le? Lemet.
Two.
Four. Preposition. And then sham. And to sham. Renowned name. These are the people that are going to be of the faith line. This is the faith line. And to Shem, name and renown. And it's Sam, Sigma, Eta, Mem, or Mu in Greek. And he had been born, him also, or also him, the father of all call B'nai, all sons of Eber. And Eber means beyond the river, from over there. It also, many people say it means root. Now, in page 720 in Brown, Driver, and Briggs, 720. Let's go here and look at that. Eber. This is the name of the Hebrews, form or inferred from. Son of Shelah, grandson of Arphaxad, Genesis 10:24, 1 Chronicles 1:18. with especially reference to Joktan. And these Joktan, these are the Arabians. Joktan. You know that Muhammad places his name through here. He didn't come through Isaac. He came from Joktan. He said he was a pure descendant of Isaac.
And these are the Japhethites?
Yeah, these are the Arabians. All right. In other words, there are brothers, cousins of the Jews. Okay? Cousins of the Jews. This is referring to the Arabians. And Shem is called Avi Kal B'nai Hever. And that is in Genesis 10 and verse 21. Eber, it's Eber in Greek, Epsilon, Beta, Epsilon, and then Rho, Eber. And it has a rough breather on it, Heber. Belongs to the Hebrews. And here we go back down here under A on page 720. It says, one from beyond the other side. One from beyond the other side. From beyond the Euphrates. From the other side of the river. From beyond the Euphrates. So that's what it's talking about. Remember it says on the other side of the river. Those on the other side of the river. This is on page 720. Beyond the Euphrates. From beyond the Jordan. All right down. All the way down through here is talking about the same place. It comes from the word Heber. Those from beyond rivers. People that have come into the land at a later period of time. Heber. And then Achi means brother. It's Adelpho in Greek. Adelpho, that's what I was thinking Greek in my head when I called you brother today. Adelphi. I get all these languages mixed up and they don't come out just exactly right sometimes. It means brother. It means brother or sister, Adelphos, Adelphe. And the brother of Japheth. Japheth, what does Japheth mean?
Spreading.
It means spreading. Fair. It means to extend. It means to spread out. And Geppettos. Remember Pocino? What's his name?
Pinocchio.
Pinocchio. His creator was what?
Geppetto.
Geppetto means Greek, which goes back to Japheth. The Greeks are pure Japhethites. The Greeks are pure Japhethites, but they're also related to who? Through Abraham's wife, Keturah. All right, so they go and these are the people that populated the islands and the mountains and the plains of Greek. The Greeks, Geppettos. The Greeks consider their initial ancestor Geppetto or Japheth. He's the older, it says. Okay, 1022. B'nai Shem Elam. We are Shur. We are Pakshat. We are Pakshad. We Ashur. We Lud. We Aram. And sons of Shem. Now this is the Fertile Crescent where all this is going on. Elam. This is Susa. Elam means youth. And Ashur. This is Persia, level plain. The builder of Nineveh and Assyria, and Arphaxad. 1 Chronicles 1:17 and 18, and Luke 3:36. And Lud, and Aram. Aram means exalted. Some of these names, there aren't really any what we call roots to them. You can't trace them all out. Let's go to 1023 now. Yuvanai, Aram, Utz, Wechol, Wegether, Wa'amash, and sons of Aram. Aram means exalted. Uz means firmness. And this is about 2200 B.C. according to some chronological calendars, okay? And Aram goes back to 2280 B.C. And then Wichul, that's Ul. It means circle. And Gether means wine press. Gethsemane means what? The place of the wine press. Okay? Wine press, Geth. 1 Chronicles 1:17. And Moshe, same thing as Meshach, Aramaic. Waters of quiet biting. Waters of quiet eating. Biting. Mosach, that's Aramaic. 2320 B.C. approximately. 1024, we are Phoxad. Yelad et Shalak, we Shalak, Yelad et Ever, and Arphaxad, he begat Shelah. Shelah. What does Shelah mean? You have any idea about that word, Brother Roger?
Queen?
You think, what?
Does it mean queen?
Shelah?
I don't know. I guess
Shelah?
Here it says missile weapon.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
missile, weapon, a sprout, shoot. That's Eber down there also. Oh. Salah, shalom,
oh.
Peace. How do you get peace?
Agreement.
How do you have to get agreement sometime? By fighting. All right. And Shelah, peace, he begat, third person singular, cal perfect, he had begotten Eber. All right, beyond the regions, page 720. Again, beyond the river. Beyond the river of the Euphrates and beyond the Jordan, okay? That's what it means, beyond those rivers. Let's go to 1025 now, and that's where we're going to go into the other area. Yule-Ever, Yulad, Shanae, Banim, Shem, Ha-Ikad, Peleg, Ki, Viamo, Niflega, Ha'aretz, Wisham, Akir, and then Yakitan. And to Eber, he had been born, he had been gotten two. They had been gotten two sons. Name Peleg, because Peleg. Peleg means divided. It means division. The word Pharisee is from this word. Peleg, because In days of him, see that possessive there? That's in the genitive. In days of him, she was divided. Diameriste, that's the Greek word in the Septuagint. Third person feminine singular, niphal perfect. She had been divided, haaretz, the earth. And the name of his brother was Joktan. This is around Kuwait, southern Kuwait. Yoktan, B.C. 2210, 1 Chronicles 1:19. Now let's go. See, we went from, where do we start tonight? 10 what?
12.
10, 12? 10, 12 through 25. Now let's go and look and see what these people were doing. What did these people contribute to the human race, to civilization? The inventiveness of the Hamite peoples. In the first of this series framework, a history of predicted the assumption that the present population of the world is to be wholly derived from the three sons, Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. It was further hypothesized that the Indo-Europeans are Japhethites, which few will challenge the Semites are of Shem, which scarcely anyone will question, and that the colored races, black, brown, and red, and yellow, are from Ham, which many will deny. Sometimes they do, but this is where they are. Now we know, since we have DNA structure, guess what? The DNA will go back. I should have brought my DNA chart tonight. On my DNA chart, it shows the whole world on it. On the DNA chart. Keep my place here. Here's the whole globe, so to speak. And here's the continents. And here's America over here. Something like this. Okay, North and South America. That doesn't look like it, but I'm just doing it real quick, okay? Sharon could draw it just right. Probably anybody could. And here's Europe and Asia and all that stuff. If you go over here and you look at my chart, you'll see these great big things like this. Big, big fields. That's where I originated. And then little bitty tiny symbols you'll see over here like that. And here, and here, and here, and here. 88.6% of my family were American Indians. But you trace it back, and guess where it goes? Right back to the Fertile Crescent, right back to this period of time right here. And this is DNA, and DNA, with DNA, you can get somebody out of jail. With DNA, you can put somebody in jail. With DNA, you can trace all mankind, and that is basically a science, isn't it? This is a true science, basically. And guess what that true science says? It shows the migration of the races just exactly like the book of Genesis teaches it. There it is. That confirms the Bible. The brown, red, and yellow are from Ham, which many will deny, but now we know better. Guess what American Indians are? They're basically what? Oriental, but they're from the Hamite side. Where do the Orientals come? They come from Ham. Okay, they're a mixture, and they bred there for hundreds of years, thousands of years, and they look like they do, and American Indians basically look like they do. But almost all American Indians have slanted eyes, like Orientals. Mine, before they're all destroyed here, they were slanted. I had real highly slanted eyes. You can look over there on that picture up there of me on there when we tried to get everybody to give their high school pictures, so we did that, and mine were very Oriental. My grandmother, my grandfather, all of them had Oriental eyes. And they were not Orientals. They were American Indians. But granted this premise, the pattern of the subsequent history of these three divisions of mankind is remarkably reflected in Scripture in a number of surprising ways, as suggested in Part 1. In this paper, my purpose is only to seek to substantiate rather bold claim that made the descendants of Ham, namely that the inventors of almost everything in basic world civilization, in its mechanical and mathematical aspects, have been invented by the servant of servants per excellence, all the Hamites. Just think about for just a minute. These are the Negroid and the Mongoloid races, the Negroid and the Mongoloid. The Negroid are the dark ones. The Mongoloids are who? These are the Orientals. And they are closely related. Of course, they are all brothers, aren't they? We all go back to Noah, and then we all go back to Adam. Which comprehends, as a matter of fact, the founders of virtually all ancient civilizations in the Middle East, Africa, the Far East, and the New World, and even the South Pacific. These people founded all these civilizations. As well as presenting an existing, recently extinct primitive people, the Hamites, it can be shown have been unexpected ways the world's great inventors, though very few people, except perhaps archaeologists, ethnologists, and cultural anthropologists, have been aware of that fact. The acknowledgement of our own debt to them is a long overdue. The arts and the architecture of such people have been recognized and admitted as remarkable enough, but the Smithsonian Institute suppressed so much archaeologically and anthropologically evidence in the Americas. Where is the most inhospitable place in the world that you can think of?
Antarctica.
Huh? Antarctica, but where else?
The Sahara Desert.
Well, where else? Where are other cold places?
Siberia.
Siberia and Alaska. Guess who's there? The Hamites. The Hamites, these people are between the Hamites, which are the Mongoloid, and the Caucasoid people. These are a cross between those people. They are the what we call the far North American Indians. Now, what did they do up there in Alaska? What are some of the things they invented in Alaska? What would be the hardest place in the world to exist in a climate so cold? And what did they build their houses out of?
Ice.
Now, have you ever thought about an igloo? What an invention that is. Think about an igloo. An igloo is sawed out of ice. Chunks of ice, and you start like this, and you go around, and you build it up. And not only that, how many of you ever seen an igloo at nighttime, with a whale oil lamp in it? It shines like a Christmas ornament out there in the snow, and that one little light in there will keep that igloo warm. That one little light. Now that's amazing, isn't it? And when you're up in these igloos, now that is a mathematical genius device to survive. There was a guy by the name of Brown, Tom Brown, that wrote a series of survival books. He was a great survivalist, and he was trained by an Apache Indian, if I remember right, this Indian, and he was up in the what we call the Pine Barrens of New Jersey. Out there, and it was out in the wilds. The most dangerous thing in the Pine Barrens was dogs, wild dogs, feral dogs. And they killed a lot of people out there. These dogs killed a lot of people in the Pine Barrens. But he went out there and he taught him how to survive. And up there in this area, it is very cold in the wintertime. And this Indian taught him to go out there in the cold and build him a snow house like an igloo and just survive. They've called Tom Brown to go out and track people that were lost with their trail very cold sometimes. And he could track them down. My wife says I could track a lizard or a frog. Well, I tracked. I went to one of the neighbor's house one time, and he was going to give me some chickens. He didn't want these chickens anymore, and there's only a few of them left. The dogs had killed them and everything else. He said, but I don't know where they are. I said, where were they last? Well, out there by the garden. I said, okay. So I went out there with a flashlight and I started tracking the chickens until I tracked them right where they were. He said, you tracked your chickens. I said, yeah, it's an animal. It makes tracks. So I found the chickens and caught them and took them home. You can learn to do all these things. Now, dugout canoes. We're talking about real basic things here. When you're in a lot of snow, what happens to you with your eyesight? You go snow blind. You see all this light, you go snow blind. Your retinas just close up. You can't stand that. So the igloos invented goggles. And they just had these goggles on. They didn't have glass in them, but they just have little bitty slits and they darkened them so there would be no glare. They run around up there in the snow all the time without being snow blind. Okay? And the wolves would come and kill their dogs and stuff like that. So they take a bone and they take it and put it in blubber, and they'd bend this bone like this with sharp ends on it, and they'd bend this bone and put it in this blubber and freeze it, and they'd put these chunks out there, And not only could they get rid of the wolves, when it went in the wolf's stomach, it went boom and killed the wolf from the inside out. These are some of the things that they did. This is the Polynesians built these dugout canoes and all types of. And the Polynesians, did they go anyplace? Mm-hmm. All over the place. From island to island, sometimes 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 miles in these little dugouts. You know who invented the telephone? The Eskimos. Eskimos have invented the telephone. It wasn't a white man. You know when somebody has a real poor signal on ham radio, I'm a ham radio operator. When they got a real poor signal on a ham radio, you sound like you're talking to a tin can. How many of you ever talked to a tin can? That's an Eskimo invention. From igloo to igloo, they would run a line and they take bones or whatever they had, like it, they would carve out wood or whatever they had, and they would make it with like a dish thing, and they would talk through this with a taut string, and they could talk from igloo to igloo. They invented the telephone. Okay? How many of you knew that? Nobody. And when you're talking about, when you got a real poor signal, you talk like you're talking to a tin can. Primitive radio. Okay? The igloos, yeah, of course. It says here that the Eskimo is one of the great triumphs of our species. He has succeeded in adapting himself to an environment which offers to man but the poorest of chances of survival. His technical solution of the problems of the Arctic are so excellent that the white settlers would have perished had they not adopted many of the elements of the Eskimo technology. Even up there today, they still have these sled races where they take these huskies and they tie them to a sled and they go 1,500, 2,000 miles. What's that, Iditarod or whatever it's called? The best known type of Eskimo house is undoubtedly the dome-shaped snow house with its ice window. With extraordinary ingenuity, the very products of the cold are used here as a protection against the cold. That's what Tom Brown says. If you're out there and you get in a blizzard, sit down, sit back, and smile, because you can sit back and rest. And he tells you how to build this snow house, and it came right straight from this invention. And when they want to learn about medicine, whatever it is, they have to go back to these people. It talks about here the Eskimos killing wolves, like I told you, with this these bones. They take them and they freeze them. And it says here that an Eskimo gets a walrus weighing more than a ton on one end of a harpoon line, and he's faced with a major engineering problem. How is he going to get that walrus or that whale? To get it from the water onto the ice, mechanically contrivances belong to a world in whose development the Eskimo has no part. No implement ever devised by him had a wheel on it. Yet, this does not prevent him from improvising the block and the tackle. You know what a block and tackle is? That's a series of shivs. How many of you know what a hay hauler's hitch is? You know what a hay hauler's hitch is? That girl can do anything. Hay hauler's hitch is where you tie a rope one way, and you throw it around here, and you take a rope, and you throw a loop on this one, throw a loop on this one, and then you start seesawing it back and forth with a block and tackle is what it is. And that's how the Eskimos got their whales out on the ice, and how they got the walruses out on the ice was these block and tackles. He is faced with a major engineering problem. How to get him from water onto the ice? Mechanical contrivances belong to the world in whose development the Eskimo has no part. No implement ever devised by him had a wheel on it, yet this does not prevent him from improvising a block and tackle that works without a pulley. He cuts slits in the hide of the walrus and a U-shaped hole in the ice some distance away. Through this, he threads a slippery rawhide line once over and once over again. He does not know the mechanical theory of the double pulley, but he does know that if he pulls at one end of the line, he will drag the Wallace out of the water onto the ice, and he is dragging more weight than he has. So he's multiplied his strength by doing this. And the deceiving thing about all this ingenuity is it is very simplicity. He makes all kinds of hunting devices that are effective in an inexpensive in time, easily repaired and usually only raw materials immediately available. His harpoon lines have floats of blown up skins attached to it so that the spirit animal is forced to come to the surface if he dives. Remember the Moby Dick and all of that stuff, you know, and Jaws, and they're doing all of the things that the Eskimos have done. To rid such aquatic animals from tearing off at high speed, dragging the hunter and his kayak, he attaches baffles to the line, which are like small parachutes that drag in the water. The bone hoop and a skin diaphragm stretch over it some thongs, and this is all he needs. To locate the seal's movements under the ice, he has devised a stethoscope, which owes nothing to its modern Western counterpart, working on the same principle, and recently a native telephone was discovered in use, made entirely from local available materials, linking two igloos with a system of intercommunication, the effectiveness of which was demonstrated on the spot to the Hudson Bay agent, D.B. Marsh, who discovered it. Marsh added at the end of his report this statement: "The most amazing thing of all was that no one in that camp had ever seen a telephone, though doubtless they had heard of them from their friends who from time to time visit Churchill." Talked about the snow goggles. Now let's go on a little bit further. Talk about the desert wilderness, I think, that Roger talked about earlier. The desert wilderness areas seem to have little to contribute to the substance of the Native American Indian. Notwithstanding this forbidding aspect to the initiated, there is a veritable storehouse of the desert from the widely scattered resources which essentials in food, clothing, shelter, tools, cooking utensils, fuel, medicine, articles of adornment, and those sacred and ceremonial rites have contributed for generations and still are contributing to the needs of the Indian and to mankind. One of the medicines that we use is a creosote bush, isn't it? To cleanse everything. This is old Indian. The Apache Indian. The Apache Indian is extremely close related to who? Who's he related to? Extremely close related to. Does anybody know? Eskimo. The Navajo and the Apaches are very closely related to the Eskimo. The Navajos even more. But the Apache developed corn. They had great, you know, and this is the funny thing. When Crook went out there, General George Crook and Sheridan and all of them, they're going to go out there and teach these Indians how to farm. Those Apaches had rancherias in the mountains and all over, and guess what they had there? They had traded from one side of America to the other for corn. Corn was developed in America. Melons were developed in the era. America. Beans were developed in America. Peppers were developed in America. Chilies. This is all American food. And these Indians are doing all this stuff all the time. I have been to one of Geronimo's hideouts. It was a rancheria up in the mountains. In that rancheria, there were plum trees. There were all types of fruit trees. There were wild peaches, all kinds of fruit, berries, and corn fields. When they went in there, they went in and cut all those trees down. And they took them from that land, which was producing because somebody wanted it, and put them out there in what they call Turkey Creek, where nobody could live, and they said, farm this now. Where you can't live. They already were where they could live. Said, let us go back home. We'll not bother you anymore. They never would let Geronimo go back home. Once he was incarcerated, they sent him to Florida, and then they sent him to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. You've been in Geronimo's cell. In Geronimo's, what did the Apaches do? Did they use horses? No. They used horses at times to ride them. They rode them till they couldn't go anymore, and then they ate them. You know how the Apache fought? They didn't fight on horses. How'd they fight? By running. An Apache Indian could run 120 miles. Now you just do that. They were the greatest runners in the world. What did Geronimo do in his cell, brother? You remember looking at that cell floor? They had him in that cell. He ran in a circle. That was a concrete floor. That concrete floor where he ran was wore down about that deep. He turned that concrete into dust. And there's a trail around. He ran, kept his strength up by running. Those people run. When a boy was 5 years old, he had to run 12 miles with a gourd of water in his mouth and had spit it out at the end of 12 miles. That's the way they trained him. This is training for hardships in the desert. It says, we could eat cactus thorns. They did. They ate cactus. They ate everything out there. They could survive on nothing. And 38 Apache Indians whipped thousands of American soldiers. They never could whip them. They finally lied to him and talked him into surrendering. By the way, you can get a book called Geronimo by Geronimo. Geronimo wrote the book. Geronimo by Geronimo. You can get that book. And he tells you the whole history of his people and everything and what he did. This, we went from the coldest place until some of the hottest and absolutely uninhabitable places in the world where these people did. We'll go on a little bit next week. Do you have any questions? Are you learning something? You like this? All right. And I'll try to get you one of those handouts from the origin of the races. Any other questions? Before I turn you loose on the world, go out and do something eternal. No? Let's have a word of prayer. Roger, can you dismiss us in prayer, bud?
Father, thank you for bringing us here again tonight so that we can hear your word and have it interpreted for us.